Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Race and racism were a big part of the local story the past year. We'll hear from religious leaders on the subject a little bit later. But first, St. Louis has always had a reputation as a strong labor town, but it is nothing today compared to what it once was. Labor union influence has declined here, as it has throughout the country. But in the decades following World War II, two men emerged on the St. Louis labor scene who influenced the movement here and elsewhere, working together to give union rank-and-file voice and influence beyond the workplace. They were influential voices in the Teamsters Union. They're the subject of a new book titled Fighting for Total Person Unionism, Harold Gibbons and Ernest Callaway, and Working Class Citizenship. The author is Robert Bussell. He directs the Labor and Education Research Center at the University of Oregon, and he joins us now from the university. Bob, so nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Don.
But I have to start by saying that Oregon is a long way from St. Louis. Why did you decide to focus on these two men and this particular city?
Well, going back to the late 1970s, I read a book by the journalist Stephen Brill called The Teamsters, and I was a union staff person at the time doing labor community work, and the last chapter of Brill's book was about Harold Gibbons. And I was fascinated by talk in that book about labor community work that Gibbons and the Teamsters did in St. Louis in the 1950s with union members actively seeking to improve the quality of life in their communities. And so I filed this away as something that was really interesting. And then 20 years later, when I was looking for a subject for a new book, I went down to Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, found 90 boxes of material on Harold Gibbons, learned much more about this idea of total person unionism, and I said, well, I think I've got a biography here. And then there was one of those happy accidents where the archivist at SIUE mentioned that there was a guy named Ernest Callaway who had been a colleague of Gibbons in some form, and he suggested I check out his papers, which were at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. So I drove across the river, found a fascinating civil rights and labor leader in Callaway, and realized that he and Gibbons had collaborated on this concept of total person unionism. So I decided then that I needed to do a dual biography, and that's how this book came about.
Before we continue with their story, I think it's important for our listeners to understand it, to define what total person unionism is.
Yes. Callaway would talk about it this way, that workers were not only economic beings, but they were also social beings. So you worked 8 hours a day to put bread on the table and for the intrinsic reward of work, but there was another 16 hours a day that you spent as a member living in a community. And what Gibbons and Callaway and the idea of unions as total persons and workers as total persons, workers had other needs. So living in a community, they were concerned about the quality of life that workers had in that community. So in their view, you could have the best conditions in your shop or workplace, but if you were out in your community and the infrastructure was crumbling, education wasn't good, transportation wasn't good, various other types of quality of life indicators were not good, you'd only come so far. The other part of that was these were men who were coal miners' sons, had grown up poor, hard scrabble in Pennsylvania and in Kentucky, and they had this really strong sense of wanting to show what working class people could accomplish. So their view was that the things that you knew, particularly as a unionized worker, about conflict resolution, power and pressure, you could take that expertise and that knowledge and use it to improve the quality of life in your community and act as an effective citizen.
Yeah, the effective citizen part is an important part of the story. I mean, certainly quality of life was important for the workers. But what they discovered over a period of time was that they also had some political clout, some political muscle, if you will.
Oh, indeed. And They realized that being involved in politics was essential, and particularly as anti-union labor legislation was passed in the late 1940s, they realized that some of the tactics that they were able to use as far as collective action by workers were diminished or even prohibited by law, so that they would have to be much more active politically. And back in the 50s, unlike today, St. Louis was still more of a swing type of political place in terms of the relative balance between Republicans and Democrats. So they really attempted to play an independent political role, being able to use their political muscle and ability to mobilize members and member votes and work on behalf of candidates to actually swing elections in their favor and levy concessions from candidates. One of the most significant manifestations of this was in the late 1940s, where a guy named Robert Pentland, who was a JCPenney's warehouse worker and a Teamsters, a Local 688, that was their local union, ran for the state legislature and won against all odds and became a really powerful political figure within the state of Missouri.
I may be wrong on this, but I think Pentland's son ultimately became a member of the Board of Aldermen here in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah, I'm not aware of that, but wouldn't it all surprise me in terms of these traditions being passed down?
Do you happen to have the numbers at the top of your head with regard to, in the, let's say, 1950 era, the percentage of the American workforce that were union members compared to today?
Yes. In fact, it's interesting you hone in on the 50s, Don, because that's the time where the percentage of workers that were unionized members of the workforce peaked in the 20th century at around 33 or 34%. Today, the total number is less than 12. And then if you break that down, the public sector is what holds that up. They're still in the mid-30s. Percentage of workers that are public sector workers who are organized, but private sector union membership is now below 7%, which is a sea change from the 1950s and Gibbons and Calloway's heyday.
And what does that mean in terms of the importance of union membership in the country today vis-a-vis 1950 or 1950s?
Well, I think it has several implications. We talk so much, and Occupy Wall Street certainly brilliantly brought this to our attention, but it's certainly an issue in the current political campaigns, both nationally and at state and local levels, that the levels of wealth and income inequality are at near record levels. And certainly when there was more effective collective bargaining and stronger unions, we had much less inequality. Wages and productivity tended to mirror each other much more closely. And again, in the world of Citizens United and the type of political contributions and power that corporations and business have, even though labor's not without some ability to compete, I think that the result, I think it really has certainly resulted in much greater inequality of bargaining power, and our politics, I think, look pretty different as well.
Do you see anything or have any kind of a gut feeling that this could change, that the unions could be revived somehow and their influence?
Well, I remain, and I've had a 40-year career in and around the union movement, and yes, I do. I see, I think people realize that something is wrong. And if you take the Bernie Sanders campaign, for example, and it's focused on inequality, he's gotten a lot farther, I think, than most people would have imagined. And certainly other people on the Democratic side are raising similar issues. The efforts to raise the minimum wage, the fight for 15, the idea that fast food workers could effectively organize is something most people didn't think could happen. And we're seeing evidence of that. I see very interesting labor community campaigns around such issues as paid sick leave and work-family balance and paid family leave. So we're having a lot more political discussion, and at least in certain cities across the country, political action on these issues. I think the idea certainly of raising the minimum wage is enormously popular, despite pundits and certain folks who say that it will wreck the economy or destroy jobs. And I also see a union movement that really is trying very hard in terms of its outreach to build a broader working class movement looking beyond its own ranks. And the last thing I'd say is I think there's much more attention being paid to an issue that Gibbons and Calloway saw as the moral barometer of the credibility and legitimacy of the union movement, and that's the fight for racial justice. There's been many more forthright statements, I think, coming from the union movement about that.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest that racial equality and economic parity were certainly hallmarks of their mission during the 50s and 60s.
Yes, they really saw that as hand in hand, and Calloway was president of the NAACP in St. Louis. Gibbons was a staunch advocate of racial justice, and both within the ranks of the union itself and out in the community, they not only talked the talk, they truly walked the walk. One example of that are taxi drivers. When Gibbons merged his union had gone independent in the late 40s, merged them with the Teamsters. The National Teamsters had very little interest in organizing African-American cab drivers. Harold Gibbons was one of the few labor leaders in St. Louis who was willing to do that. And again, at various points, even with backlash from some segments of the white members of Local 688, he and Calloway never wavered in their advocacy of racial justice.
What brought the two of these men together? You mentioned their hardscrabble backgrounds. Both had coal mining histories, family histories. What brought them together to work as this team that they became?
Well, one thing I would say is they meet briefly in Chicago in the late 1930s, and they're both young men and are rising to positions of influence in the labor movement. Gibbons, at age 26, is a vice president of the National American Federation of Teachers, and Calloway is education director and editor of the publication for the Red Caps Union called Bags and Baggage. I think in addition to their coal mining past, they were both socialists, so politically they came up in a similar type of movement. They both had been educated at independent labor schools. They both were staunch advocates of racial justice. And the way the story goes, in the late 1940s or just before 1950, the story goes that Gibbons and Calloway meet in a bar in Chicago. Maybe that's the place where the best things happen politically sometimes. And Gibbons says to Calloway, "Can you come down to St. Louis for 3 months to help me form a research department in Local 688? And Calloway assents, and as they say, the rest is history, that was the beginning of this 20-year working relationship. But I think they had an enormous amount of things in common in terms of how they saw the world, their ambitions for the union movement. And again, this really deep-seated desire to show what working-class people could do, the potential that they had.
They had a lot in common, but what about the things that they didn't have in common that, when they brought them together, made the two a stronger one, if you will?
Well, I think that there was a way in which, again, I think they were in fundamental agreement on most things, but one of the things that Calloway brought to the table was his activism within the African-American community. So Calloway becomes president of the St. Louis NAACP in the mid-50s, and so he really... It becomes Gibbons's beachhead or outreach person even more so to the African-American community in St. Louis. And although sometimes people thought that Calloway was Gibbons's stalking horse, or they would say, we can't tell if he's talking Teamster or he's talking civil rights, he sometimes suffered for that. But I think it became a very fruitful alliance in terms of the grassroots work Calloway was doing in the African-American community and the grassroots work that Gibbons was doing with this community stewards program and Local 688. So it was a very fruitful alliance in that regard. Although I will say in the 1960s, I think they diverged somewhat because Calloway moved away from more of an advocacy of direct action and civil disobedience regarding the black freedom struggle, and Gibbons seemed much more friendly towards those sorts of tactics. So there was at least, I believe, somewhat of a tactical difference they had in the 1960s, although they come together in terms of a program in the Tandy area of St. Louis in the 1960s, which is quite effective.
Indeed, and still with the effectiveness still a part of the St. Louis fabric today. I'm talking to Robert Bussell, the author of Fighting for Total Person Unionism, Harold Gibbons and Ernest Calloway, and Working Class Citizenship. We'll come back and continue our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, perhaps you have recollections of the union time here in St. Louis, we'd love to hear from you. 382-8255 is our number. 382, or you can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. Back with Robert Bussell in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Robert Bussell, author of Fighting for Total Person Unionism. Bob, just having read that story about what's going on with U.S. Steel, I just wonder how that might have been handled 40 years ago.
Well, 40 years ago, the Teamsters and other unions, I think this is one of the changes, is that one of the great achievements of unionism during those years was their efforts to take wages out of competition, to have regional agreements, master agreements, national agreements, so that workers had substantially the same wages and working conditions in different parts of the country. And in the wake of capital flight and globalization, that's been much, much harder to maintain. Although and also, the strike as a weapon or a tool of unions of last resort, but one that was much more effective back in the 40s and 50s, it's been more difficult to sustain those today.
You know, getting back to Calloway and Gibbons, what was the reaction of the political and business elite here in St. Louis like reaction to them at that time, 50s and 60s?
Well, there's a great quote from Jimmy Hoffa that I will use, I think, that that encapsulates, the, that I would use to answer your question, Don. When Hoffa and Gibbons met early in the 50s, and as the story goes, they had come back from a bargaining session, and Hoffa reportedly said to Gibbons, he called him Gibbons, he says, "Gibbons, there are people back in Detroit that don't like me." He said, "But those fellas in St. Louis actually hate you." And I think that there was this sense that Gibbons was this scary fellow, and Calloway is somebody who was allied with him as well, because a guy like Hoffa, I think most of the people in the business community and even the political community, they might not necessarily have liked his tactics or the power that the union had, but it was within a certain type of confine, mostly about improving the wages and working conditions for Teamsters members. But Gibbons had much broader social ambitions, and I think that people were really concerned about, well, what does this guy really want? You know, how big are his ambitions? And that's what's fascinating. In the 1950s, you see certainly collusion between federal authorities and local authorities, where they go through the union's records and really try to find something to get Gibbons. And the most that they can come up with is a technical violations of labor law, which are thrown out several times in court. But I think that there was a real sense, certainly in the 50s and 60s, that the guy did have integrity, certainly, but they just weren't sure about his social ambitions. It isn't until the 1960s that the irony is that somebody who was a real pariah then is asked in the late 1960s, in effect, to help save the city during a public housing tenants' rent strike in 1969.
There was also the element of the organized crime connection and suspicion with regard to the Teamsters Union and others, but the Teamsters in particular. That would cause some and generate some fear, I would think.
Oh, yes, there certainly was. I think when Gibbons aligns with Hoffa, in part actually to oust mob elements from the union in St. Louis, but there is concern, certainly. I mean, there are several concerns. One is the power that the union has at that time to actually shut down the regional economy through direct action and strikes. The other is, then, is St. Louis becoming even a larger branch of some sort of organized crime? So I think that that was certainly a concern, but I think the greater concern, really, because most people in St. Louis, I think, in the business and civic community, understood that Gibbons wasn't really aligned with those elements, although he certainly had to accommodate them. They were just concerned about the political role that Gibbons played and how it actually interfered with some of their plans, particularly around urban renewal and downtown revitalization.
Well, from your book and from what I remember of Harold Gibbons, he was more inclined to socialize with celebrities.
Well, that's an interesting element that Gibbons was certainly somebody who enjoyed the nightlife, and he had relationships with that group of Hollywood entertainers that came to be known as the Rat Pack, and Frank Sinatra was a particularly close friend of his. The other thing that Gibbons did was they ran a lot of charity shows in St. Louis that were raised enormous amounts of money for charity, and members of the Rat Pack, Sinatra et al., would come in. But yes, Gibbons had, I think, very close and cordial relationships with people in the entertainment world.
Nothing like that with Mr. Calloway.
No, well, Callaway, certainly through the NAACP and his role there, he was a respected figure, certainly locally and nationally. He did know a number, I think, of prominent people and entertainers and some celebrities, but he was more a person, he was less about the nightlife, I think, and somebody who was really known for, he was this great self-taught intellectual who wrote widely and eloquently, was a research director for the union. So he was somebody that was much, very comfortable marshaling facts and figures, and as Bill Clay once said about him, using them as ammunition.
And he had a more stable home life with his wife, DeVern, than Mr. Gibbons apparently had.
It would seem to be the case. And, of course, you also, yeah, when you talk about Ernest Callaway, you certainly have to talk about DeVern Callaway, who he helped manage her campaign that in the early 60s elected her as the first African-American female legislator in Missouri. And they were a very dynamic team, I think, and there were ways in which they certainly supported each other, picked each other up, and really were a what we might today call a power couple.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of phone calls, Bob, if you don't mind. We'll start with Eric calling from St. Louis. Eric, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Great show, and I'm wondering if you talk anything about in the book about the development of Consul Plaza, which was a unique, I think, development being from the real estate industry, and it was also the founding, really, of McCormick Barron when Terry McCormick met Richard Barron as part of the rent strike effort. That company has now gone on to develop affordable and workforce housing around the United States and one of the best in the country.
Yes, absolutely, Eric. There's so one thing that Gibbons particularly was interested in was, and in Callaway too, they thought that housing really was a part of the civic and public health life of a community. So they recognized that it was hard for senior citizens actually, once they had retired, to live in dignity. And that was a huge thing, Council Plaza in the Mill Creek Valley area of St. Louis, where the promises of urban renewal had not fully materialized, that was built in the 1960s with creative financing, both from the federal government and from Teamsters pension funds. And then subsequently, during this rent strike, where Gibbons played a major role in helping to settle that strike, and the union actually ran public housing in St. Louis for several years, Richard Barron, who you referenced, was the legal aid lawyer advising those tenants and was so inspired by that effort that he's gone on to a very distinguished career building housing, affordable housing, but housing that has amenities surrounding it that really attempts to create kind of a total, it's kind of the total person concept in housing. So yes, it is an important part of the story that I do talk about in the book.
You mentioned, I'm sorry, go ahead. Eric, you still there?
Yes, I am. That is just fantastic, because these roots and these foundations, we usually don't connect the dots a lot, particularly in this community. There's a lack of collaboration, I think, or a lack of understanding how these things fit together to really build total community. So I really appreciate it, and I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Eric, thanks for the call. Let's take a call from Dale in Melville. Dale, go ahead.
Yes. My mom and dad were both in unions. I grew up in a union household. My dad and the Teamsters, my mother and the machinist, and I was in unions my whole life. I'm now retired, and I was on a negotiating committee before I retired, and I noticed that one of the arguments within the group was that one of the statements was that we were victims of our own success. That now, back when people went on strike, they really didn't have hardly anything to lose. And now, you know, people have cars, mortgage payments, and house payments. And if they go on strike, they can't last very long without the money. Most people don't save as much money as they'll need. I went through a five-month strike back in 79, and I was okay, but I was probably one of the lucky ones. And I just, they even threatened to tell you, go ahead and go on strike. And they already had an ad put up in the paper. They could take our jobs. So, you know, that just opens the door and makes it look like, well, they're really trying to get right to work in here. And I'm going to dwell on that. It's maybe a little bit of a separate discussion, but at the same time, it gave us a look at what would happen if there were new unions and there was a right to work situation.
Dale, let me interrupt only because we're getting short on time, and I want to give Bob a chance to respond to you.
Well, I would just say, Dale, I think that certainly for Gibbons and Callaway, the Teamsters in a number of unions back in the 50s and even the 60s, certainly the idea of the strike as a tool of last resort and the ability to exercise leverage in collective bargaining loomed fairly large. I would say that following the Patco strike in 1981, President Reagan's firing of air traffic controllers who went on strike, the actual numbers of strikes per year and per decade has dwindled dramatically. And so I think the real challenge, particularly, well, both in the private and public sector, is where does leverage come from? Because when you, the threat of an effective strike has diminished to a very large degree. So I think there are unions and organizations trying to figure out how to revive that, because I think the ability to demonstrate the collective power of workers, that was at the root of Gibbons and Callaway's vision, both economically, socially, and politically.
I have another caller I'd like to take. It's Larry calling from St. Louis. And Larry, identify yourself if you would.
Hi, my name's Larry Gibbons, and Harold Gibbons was my father. And I just wanted to call and give a vote of support to what the author has done. I spoke with him once several years ago about when he was doing his research, and I think he's done a wonderful job of bringing this together. And I knew, of course, grew up around Ernest Callaway and his family. Although by the 60s, Ernest had slowed down a bit, and his wife, Mrs. Callaway, was probably the more dynamic of the duo. But it's an excellent job you've done, and I really want to tell you that I'm glad somebody still remembers this stuff.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. That means a lot.
I had the pleasure of meeting your father on a number of occasions, Larry, and found him a most impressive guy. I was, as I mentioned to Bob before we went on the air, the thing that impressed me most, I guess, was the fact that in his office he had about 500 pictures of himself with the best-known celebrities in the world. It was kind of a neat thing to see.
It was, but I think in part that ego is necessary if you want to accomplish the kinds of things he was trying to do.
Well, he accomplished
a
lot.
He had a fair share.
He did. Larry Gibbons, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
How many strikes, Bob Bussell, were conducted in St. Louis? Do you know during the period, 50s, 60s, were there a lot of them?
Yeah, I don't have an exact number, Don, but my sense was that it was still a tool that the union used, the Teamsters and I would say others, and they often would use it to strike for recognition of the union, because there's just been ways in which labor law employers have played loose with that or taken advantage of delaying tactics. And so wherever they could use direct action, they certainly were willing and prepared to do that. That remained an important weapon in their arsenal, even as labor law began to narrow some of the ways in which workers could act in solidarity and in support of strikes, but that still was very important to their tactical approach.
What would you say that the lasting legacy of these two gentlemen was for our community?
Well, I'd say several things. There are certain specific institutions, the Metropolitan Sewer District, the Bi-State Transit, the Community College System. You look at those sorts of things, work that they did in housing Council Plaza, they actually either created or inspired lasting institutions. So those things, I think, are very important. And then I would go into the area of sensibility, that just this idea that workers could use their expertise and knowledge, insight from the workplace to inform and enhance their lives as citizens, to be active and effective in their community, not just voting, but actually to really be involved as active civic participants. I think that's really a very critical part of their legacy that still speaks to us today.
We only have about a minute left. You write in the book that workers seem to become apathetic in the late 60s, union workers. Why was that?
Well, I don't know if I'd say so much apathetic as I think that there were social movements that tended to crowd out the labor movement to some degree. And I think particularly for white workers, and this was something that Gibbons and Calloway encountered with their advocacy of racial justice, there were white workers that began to feel as if their position was being threatened. Certainly the rise of inflation, the Vietnam War, there were certainly causes, I believe, for insecurity. And then there also were workers who moved to the suburbs, who were less connected to some of the dynamic activities in the cities, and to some degree, too, a certain complacency with getting certain levels of wages and benefits, I think, did begin to set in certain sectors.
There were certainly a lot of distractions in the 1960s. There's no question about that. I'm going to thank you so much, Bob Bussell, for being with us. I'll remind folks that the name of the book is Fighting for Total Person Unionism, Harold Gibbons and Ernest Calloway and Working Class Citizenship. And what I would remind our listeners of is an awful lot that we weren't able to talk about today because of time constraints. But a lot of famous names pop up in this book. Bobby Kennedy certainly is one of them. There's a role that he played during that period of time and many others. So if you're interested in the St. Louis local history and labor history, this is the book for you. Again, Bob, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Don.
Coming up, religious leaders weigh in on the issue of racism. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.